We'll call the meeting of the Energy Finance and Policy Division to order. Single item on the agenda tonight. Unfortunately, we weren't able to deal with in our regular time slot this afternoon is the continuation of House File 355, Representative Falk's seabed contracts bill. And we do, before we get back to that order of business, have the minutes from our previous meeting somewhere here. And I would entertain a motion for their approval.
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Purcell. Motion is before us. Are there any additions or corrections to the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of their adoption, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Representative Falk. Do you have any opening comments? Otherwise, we will go straight to the testimony that I must apologize to all the testifiers who have stuck it out. These things happen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I do not have any opening comments. I would like to get into the remainder of the testimony for people who have signed up to speak on behalf of the bill.
Mr. Pomeroy mentions that we do need to move the bill to get it back before us, and I believe that your motion would be that the bill be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I do move that the bill be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
Very well. Members, the agenda that we have was printed for this afternoon. There are a couple of testifiers that will not be able to testify this evening, at least two that we're aware of. Mike Franklin from the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. He has left his written remarks, which I think you'll find in your packets, and John Farrell from the Institute for Local Self-Reliance will not be here either. As far as we know, everyone else will be. And first on the agenda is Glenn Scarbacca from Great River Energy.
Mr. Chairman, members, good evening. I'm Glenn Scarbacca. I'm manager of resource planning with Great River Energy. Given the hour, I'll try to be brief. We have three major concerns with the bill. One is its cost. One is the nature of the standard contract. And the third are the quotas that the bill establishes for seabed. Let me start with cost. The last Wednesday, you were provided with some cost analyses in support of the bill. And my comment on this analysis is that it's really an apples to oranges comparison. The present value that is determined pursuant to the language in the bill is not representative of current market prices. If this sort of analysis is going to be used, or any type of present value analysis is going to be used to evaluate projects, it's very important that it be done on an apples-to-apples basis, and this does not do that. If we look at the numbers that, again, are in the handout from last Wednesday, you'll see that the price of the seabed project that is supposed to provide a present value of about $50 per megawatt hour or 5 cents per kilowatt hour works out to be about $97 per megawatt hour for the first 10 years and then $75 thereafter. The way we would look at that type of a project or characterize it at GRE would be to look at its levelized value, which is, in other words, is the payment stream level over the life of the contract that yields the same present value as the payment stream proposed here. And if we were to take that approach, this turns out to be about an $89 project. In other words, it's equivalent to a wind project priced at $89 for 20 years. That $89 is well above the current MISO market prices, and it's well above the prices of other wind proposals that we have looked at GRE and other PPAs that we have signed. In fact, it's not close. It's way above those prices. One comment I'd like to make, there was testimony last Wednesday that utilities cannot get flat pricing from non-seabed projects. That has simply not been our experience at GRE. All of our projects have been done with flat pricing, and we continue to get proposals done in that manner. So again, the numbers here that seem to be about $50 per megawatt hour are really closer to $89 when looked at the equivalent flat pricing. As far as what that premium is worth, the cost to it for GRE would be about $10 million a year if GRE were to assume a proportional share of the amount of the quota of seabed established in this bill. And there was a question on Wednesday about, well, what does that mean in terms of consumers? In very, very rough numbers, that turns out to be about $9 per year per residential household. Now, $9 doesn't sound like a lot of money in a way, but it all adds up. In terms of our concerns about the standard contract, we're sensitive to the concerns that were raised on Wednesday about the length of the negotiating process for negotiating power purchase agreements. And that applies not just to seabed, but to other projects as well. The proposal in this bill is that the Public Utilities Commission would be directed to establish a contract. That contract would be non-negotiable. And in other words, it would tie the hands of both the developers and the utility who would like to enter into an agreement. We feel that that approach fails to recognize that every project is unique. There are certainly a lot of common characteristics among projects, but there are also unique aspects about a project, about a particular developer, or about a particular utility. And furthermore, circumstances change, and establishing a single contract with non-negotiable terms would not allow the contract to accommodate changes in circumstances as they happen. Instead of that sort of approach, we really need flexibility. We need the ability to negotiate particular contracts with particular projects so that we can come up with the best situation, a real win-win for both the utility and the developer. What we would suggest in place of this non-negotiable contract is instead a template contract, a contract that would be created as a starting point for power purchase agreements around which exceptions could be negotiated to fit particular circumstances. And I'm thinking of something kind of analogous to in residential real estate. You know, it's very common to have a form contract that's rather lengthy, has a lot of small print in it, but you only have to learn that contract once. And having made that investment, then you can adapt the language to the particular circumstances at hand. And we would strongly suggest that that sort of approach would help streamline the process because, again, if all the utilities and the project started from that common point, we would have the same understanding of where we're going, where we're coming from, and not have to relearn it for each particular project. We suggest that that does not have to be something put together by the Public Utilities Commission. One possible venue for developing such an agreement would be the American Wind Energy Association. I do not know for sure if they would be interested in that exercise or not, but it does seem like a possible venue. Lastly, we have a concern about the quota established for seabed projects in the bill. Essentially, what that would require us to do is take a time out for some indeterminate period of developing other projects while we fill out the seabed quota. And the problem we have with that is that there are a number of other projects that are ripe for development in the coming months and years. These are projects that have been through the transmission queue, that have their transmission arrangements nearing completion, that would be in a position to have turbines lined up, financing lined up, and so forth. And basically, this legislation as written would preclude us from pursuing those types of projects, meaning that if you if you buy into the concept, I guess, that the earliest wind projects are the low-hanging fruit, and that they will get more difficult to develop over time, it really precludes us from pursuing the low-hanging fruit in the earlier years, and would mean, I guess, that the low-hanging fruit in terms of projects that are ripe for development would have to go to other states. Again, those are concerns about the bill. We are certainly interested in seabed projects. We think seabed projects have some unique opportunities that could be developed. For example, smaller projects finding niche locations in transmission where not a lot of upgrades would be required is an opportunity. The opportunity to develop unique deals in turbine supply, the possibility of aggregating smaller projects. These are all opportunities that would allow seabed to compete truly on an apples-to-apples basis. We think that's entirely possible. This bill, however, does not do that. Those are my comments. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for Mr. Scarbox?
I have one quick one.
Representative Beard.
I have one quick one, Mr. Chair. Mr. Scarbaca, the wind power contracts that you've entered into now, that might be proprietary, but can you share with us what the average length of those contracts is and the nature, if they are long, are there revisiting opportunities to revisit in those things?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, they're all long-term contracts. They vary a bit in length from 15 to 25 years.
Mr. Chair, then 20 years is not unusual. That was what I'm wondering here.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, not all.
No, that's all for now. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Breyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to ask Representative Falk to respond to Mr. Scarabaca's recommendation for a template contract as opposed to the standard contract.
Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Breyer. That was part of the discussions that came out of the advisory task force, was to create a standardized contract. Now, whether we call a template contract or a standardized contract, the same thing or different thing. Realistically, this is not a complex transaction, and the flag falls down. But really, when you're delivering 60-cycle power with standard reliability criteria, you should be getting paid X cents for it, and there's a way that we can work out what the insurance requirements are, what the security deposits are, what the nature, and that should be standardized. So I think that when we look at creating a standardized contract with a standardized, you put in X, you're going to deliver X amounts of megawatts or a certain amount of power for X cents per kilowatt hour, it's not a complex transaction. So that's the reason why we are seeing the need, because when these contracts are negotiated for a year, year and a half, 2 years, without anything being signed, the only people getting paid are the lawyers, it slows up development opportunities. And that's why we haven't been able to get on line as many projects as we would like. This is really reactionary to the fact that there has been a very slow process to get seabed done, because I don't think that there has been as much of an effort to really get behind it. And when we have people, we have consumers who are purchasing electricity wanting to have the opportunity to reinvest in their communities. And I think if you look at people and talk to them on the whole, given the option, would they rather have a project owned by a Minnesota company, a group of Minnesota investors, a school, a city, a county, economic development agency, and versus something like Florida Power and Light or an Exco? The choice is very clear that they support local ownership. They support the companies that are paying taxes in Minnesota. They support the companies that are keeping the jobs local. So we're really trying to push that forward as a development tool, and this is to help speed up the process, which has been far too lengthy.
Are there further questions? Mr. Scarbaca does bring up an interesting question, since Great River, of course, is a co-op owned. Has this question of community-based economic development been brought before the various co-op memberships? Is there any kind of an official or even unofficial position regarding seabed with the co-op membership?
Mr. Chairman, I can't speak for the co-op members I guess I can only speak for DRE.
I guess what I'm asking is, did DRE arrive at this position in consultation with its membership, or is this basically a management position?
Mr. Chairman, I would say I can't point to a vote of the membership that would necessarily support this. I do know that the direction that we get, that I get from the members, is that they are very concerned about cost. I think that they see seabed as something that is good to have, everything else being equal. But in terms of a subsidy for it, I don't sense, I've never seen a strong support for paying much of a premium for it. But I can't point to a specific vote in that sense.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Sundberg, did you wish to comment? Or? Well, you're not on the list, but...
In response to your questions, Mr. Chair, I'm Lee Sundberg with the Minnesota Rural Electric Association, and Mr. Scarbacca's testimony is consistent with the policy of the Minnesota Rural Electric Association, which does represent all of the electric cooperatives, and there is we have a policy, like I said, that is consistent, and the members have voted on it.
Thank you. Next on our list, we have Blake Nixon. Mr. Nixon, present. Next, and welcome to the committee.
Thank you for having me, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to testify in favor of the bill before us. Like was mentioned, my name is Blake Nixon. I'm the president of a local Twin Cities-based wind development company called Geronimo Wind Energy. We've developed two seabed projects that have been certified and are up and operating as of today. We're developing numerous projects throughout the Upper Midwest, including multiple seabed projects throughout Minnesota today. I want to be brief, since it's late and everybody would like me to be. Just offer a couple comments and then a couple of things to noodle on for additional thought. First and foremost, I applaud the recent changes to the bill. I think that it's moved to a more all-encompassing bill that acknowledges the broader seabed efforts and initiatives that are already underway around the state, so I applaud that. As a past and current and future seabed developer, I can share that we have been frustrated over time with the, shall I call it, lack of progress and potentially even lack of interest in seabed getting accomplished in the realms where it gets contracted. We have first-hand experience about the difficulties of taking legitimate arm's-length negotiations to closure on seabed projects, thus in support of a standardized or, as Mr. Scarbacca just said, templated type contract for seabed projects. We believe that a mandate is appropriate and necessary for seabed to be taken seriously and to show the progress that it certainly could and should. I'll offer that real competition does exist in the seabed world, and seabed contracts will deliver competitively priced power in the aggregate. I know this because we've bid into numerous RFPs and not been selected. We develop projects generally between 20 and 50 megawatts in size, so they do have some scale benefits. they can be generating power in the realm of competitively priced non-seabed projects. I did a little bit of analysis of the infamous MISO Q that has been referred to many times in this committee. The MISO Q currently has 79 projects under 50 megawatts in size in Minnesota alone that account for 2,500 megawatts of potential generation. I would say, this is my opinion, not fact, but I would say that a 50 megawatt and below project is likely to be a community-based project. Most larger commercial wind development companies generally like to focus on projects north of 50 megawatts, generally north of 100 megawatts in specific. And many of these projects are in the Group 5, which is a segment of the MISO queue that's under study today, or what's called the definitive planning phase, or the DPP, sometimes called the fast track, which means that it's moving through the process relatively quickly, which I know is an irony relative to what you've probably heard over time from MISO. My point in those facts is that there is a market for seabed. It can be competitive, and given the broader construct of this bill, I think we'll move towards fabulous rural community development through competitive price power for the broader rate base of the state. The two thoughts that I'd like to bring up about the bill, again, I'm testifying in favor of the bill, but I'd like to have further thought about. There's two potential unintended consequences that I think should be recognized. The way it's currently drafted does not take into account the idea of proportionality. We've done both of our contracts with a off-taker that has taken seabed seriously, has, you know, put 35 megawatts of seabed into the ground, and that's quote-unquote more than their percentage share of what it would be on this calculation in their Minnesota load. But let's not punish the people who have taken it seriously so far, or who will take it seriously right out the gates when it comes time to enact the law. And though I do have frustrations with the contract negotiations that I've had in the past, standard contracts are tough, and I do believe that a templated form with a very keen eye on a handful of very important contract issues that quite frankly can be the go-no-go for a smaller, lesser capitalized community-based developer is a way that would allow for a business with a lot of change in very short periods of time to adapt to an adjusting marketplace that's always moving. That's all I have, Mr. Chairman.
Excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Nixon. Are there any questions for this witness? Seeing none, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Single chance? Yeah. Daniel King, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Betsy Engel King, and I am Director of Resource Planning and Acquisition for Xcel Energy. I appreciate the opportunity to come and talk to you tonight about this bill. We've heard a lot of testimony about this bill, and I think that it's important to step back and think about what this bill really is about and what it does. On Wednesday, in testimony, you heard a great deal about energy security. We believe that it's extremely important for us to address the energy security issues of our country. And we believe that the legislature recognized that when they passed the most aggressive renewable energy standards of any state in the nation. This bill will not create 1 kilowatt hour more of renewable energy than you already have ordered in the renewable energy standard. We heard a lot of testimony about climate change. And we believe that addressing the issue of climate change is very important. In fact, we have actually put forward a future plan that would reduce our carbon emissions by 30% by 2025, which is precisely the guidance that the legislature gave us when they passed the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Act. This bill will not save one ton of carbon more than what you have already given us guidance on in the Greenhouse Gas Reduction Act. So what will this bill do? This bill will confer a premium price on a select group of developers in Minnesota. And what I hope to do with my testimony is address four areas with you. First, I want to talk a little bit about the pricing and the way that the price is calculated and who's going to get this price and what that might mean. Second, I'd like to talk just a little bit about some of the technical issues with the price. I'd like to give you a little bit of background on where Xcel is on CBED and where we think things can help and not. And then finally, if there's still some time and you're willing to listen to me, I'll just talk a little bit about the standard contract. We've passed out a handout, and for purposes tonight, I've decided that I'm not going to talk about how much wind costs relative to other things that we can purchase. In fact, we've even gone on record as saying, in a lot of cases, particularly with the production tax credit, wind is one of the most cost-effective energy resources we can buy. I'm not going to talk to you about what private wind or Xcel-owned wind costs compared to CBED. I am going to provide you with information on what, based on our vast experience with CBED costs, and what the pricing for this proposal will be in contrast with that. We've seen some pricing streams and we've seen a lot of discussion about the price of these projects. What I have put in front of you and what's been, I think, been handed out to you is a handout that's titled Cost of House File 357 Compared to Current Contracts. And in making this comparison, I have taken a contract that we signed late in 2008. It is a 4.5 megawatt CBED contract. I have not given you the precise front-loaded pricing of this contract. I've given you a contract that works out to the same net present value or essentially the same effect and levelized cost as the actual contract. However, one of the things that you will note about this contract is that the price actually begins at just above 7 cents a megawatt hour. And it ends at just below 6 cents a megawatt hour, about 5.8 cents a megawatt hour. This is an actual 4.5 megawatt CBED project who has signed a contract with us and is under construction. Now, let's look at what that means. If we look at it from a levelized basis, Mr. Scarbacca was talking about what would the price of this contract be like if we just charged you the same rate over all of the years. This contract would be $65. On a levelized basis, that's what we would pay per megawatt hour, or if you want to put it in kilowatt hour, cents per kilowatt hour, terms, 6.5 cents per kilowatt hour for every year of the contract. Now, I'm comparing that in this with a contract that has some front-loaded pricing that would equal the index that the authors say is represented in this bill. Now, it's actually not represented in this bill because there's some technical issues with it, but I can talk about that as well. I went back and calculated the average MISO day-ahead price for the Minnesota Hub for 2008, and it equals roughly $48 a megawatt hour. This is the net present value price that they would like to set the CBED contract on. And I took that and I turned it into a front-loaded 20-year contract price that would get us that number. Now, there's lots of other examples. I think you saw another one that was passed out by Mr. Jewell. But based on this calculation, I chose a levelized front-loaded contract that would equal 10 cents a kilowatt hour, $100 a megawatt hour in the first 10 years of the contract, and 8 cents a kilowatt hour, or $80 a megawatt hour, in the last 10 years of the contract. If we levelize the cost of this contract, it is actually equivalent to $93.43 a megawatt hour. If you are to pass this bill, which becomes effective on the day after enactment, so perhaps by the middle of May, we would sit down and sign a contract for the exact same project as we signed just 2 months ago for a price that is fully, almost 50% higher than what our current contractor is willing to accept for his project. If we extend that over 200 megawatts, we are essentially saying that these projects are worth $17.5 million a year, or $500,000 per 5-megawatt project, than what current developers are willing to accept. Now, why is this happening? We have to assume that the contracts we're signing now are providing enough money over the life of the contract for these developers to recover their costs and for them to recover a fair return on their investment. Otherwise, they wouldn't sign the contract. There are a number of barriers to seabed development. Xcel Energy acknowledges them, and I'll talk about them. I'll talk about a few of them. Some of them have included the ability to interconnect to the grid, the inability to obtain turbines, the lack of financing. At one point, Xcel Energy had even signed 170 megawatts of contracts that were in default because the project could not meet project milestones. At no point in any of these contracts that we worked on was price an issue. In fact, Xcel Energy went back to the commission on one contract 3 times and asked for price increase amendments so we could get the project done. That project is still not developed. Just going to talk just a little bit about where we see seabed developing in Minnesota and what kinds of barriers we've seen. We started soliciting for seabed proposals shortly after you passed the initial legislation. We made a commitment to the governor that we would have 500 megawatts of seabed online by the end of 2010. We are still working for that commitment. As soon as the legislation passed, we received inquiries for over 1,000 megawatts of seabed. We selected 500 megawatts of those projects to negotiate with. We signed 200 megawatts of contracts. We signed 200 megawatts of contracts. And to date, 78 megawatts of that seabed has been developed. That means there were fully over 100 megawatts of those contracts that went into default and could not be developed. In 2007, we had a second seabed solicitation. We received 700 megawatts of proposals. We selected 409 megawatts to negotiate with, 17 contracts, and out of that solicitation, we signed 2 megawatts of seabed. Not for reasons of price, but for other reasons, such as the extremely congested MISO interconnection group. In 2008, last June, we had another solicitation. We received 600 megawatts of interest. We selected 419 megawatts for negotiation. These were all projects that we believed could be interconnected to the grid based on the new MISO queue process. Out of that process so far, we have signed 39.5 megawatts, which we expect to be online by the end of this year. We are continuing to negotiate with 224 megawatts of projects. Now I'm going to share with you some hot-off-the-presses news that I haven't even sent to my boss yet, because we actually conducted another seabed solicitation in January of this year, and we received proposals on Friday. And as I was leaving to come to the hearing that didn't happen this afternoon, my staff was still opening proposals and was tallying it. And the results that they gave me as I walked out the door was, at that tally, they had received 40 proposals, totaling in excess of 2,000 megawatts of seabed. The projects vary between 18 megawatts, as the smallest projects that were bid, to 150 megawatts, as the largest projects that were bid at the time that they had completed their tally, was giving me their tally. And the price, the levelized price for these seabed contracts, were hovering right between about 6.6 and 7 cents. A kilowatt hour. With that much interest out there, with that many people who are willing and say that they're able to put up projects at that price, why do we need to pass a bill where we will pay people 10 cents a kilowatt hour to do these projects? We talk a lot about the difference between small projects and large projects. But CBET projects are CBET projects. They all have to pass the same requirement, which is that they return at least 51% of their gross revenues to the community. We have CBED projects out there who have indicated a willingness with us to sign contracts. I just want to talk just a little bit about the use of the MISO index as your cap. When we first passed the CBED legislation, front-loaded contracts weren't something that anybody had dealt with a lot. We were used to dealing with, you know, flat contracts for wind or escalated contracts, as people talk about. And I agree with Mr. Starbaca. We're currently getting pricing that's all over the map. And so one of the real concerns was, well, how do we compare a front-loaded contract with a levelized contract? How are we ever going to know if we're getting the same value out of this? How are we going to pick between two projects? So we came up with this concept called a net present value rate. It's actually a defined term in 216B1612. And the idea of the net present value rate is that we're going to create a stream of payments, and then we're going to net present value all of that back to the current year. We're going to use the utilities discount rate, and we're going to divide it by the number of megawatt hours that the project is going to produce, and that's going to come up with a rate. And if we do that for every single project that we're comparing, that net present value rate is going to tell us which projects are the best from an economic standpoint. At the time that we passed that legislation, there was some concern about whether these projects would be too expensive, and so we put a cap on the net present value rate. It was 2.7 cents at that point in time. And that worked fine for a couple of years. And after a couple of years, the costs started increasing, and we got to a point where the cost of these contracts from a net present value rate was more than 2.7 cents, and so no CPED projects could happen under the law. So we came back to the legislature, and we didn't recommend that you raise the cap. We recommended that you remove the cap, because we had seen enough CBED projects to know that there were competitive offers out there. And in fact, they were even competitive with some of the larger projects or our own projects, that we didn't feel like we needed the discipline of a cap. Today, these developers of under 5 megawatt projects are coming to you and saying, not only do we need to reinstate the cap, we're not even going to make it a cap, we're going to make it a required price, and it's going to be double. It's going to be double what you said it should be less than 5 years ago. The use of the MISO market price as the cap or the net present value rate for this bill is an obfuscation. The price that is being set by this bill is not related to market price, nor is it related to the cost of developing these facilities. We've seen the cost of developing these facilities. We've got it in all of these bids that just came in on Friday. It's in the high 6 cents. That's what we know. On Wednesday, Mr. Jewell, who I highly respect and who's done a great deal for wind in the state of Minnesota, told you that using the MISO market price as the net present value rate for this bill was the same as locking in the market price for the next 20 years. This is incorrect, and I think my cost example has demonstrated it to you. What the net present value rate really says is, if I pay for all this wind right now at this price, I will get it over the next 20 years delivered to me. But I'm not going to pay for all this wind right now at that price. I'm going to want to invest my money and pay for it later. This price that's being developed by this bill is fully 50% higher than some of the CBED projects that we have seen come into our office just last Friday. You can't get bids that are any fresher than that. Now, just to discuss a little bit about the technical issues, if you want to use the MISO index, it's as good a way as determining what you think the cap should be. I mean, understand that means right now the cap is about 4.8 cents. You know, you could also take the average temperature at Embarrass, Minnesota for last year and say that's the cap. And then I'm not sure it would be, you know, probably 32.6 degrees or something like that. But really, use of the MISO price is arbitrary. What you're trying to figure out is what's the cap should be this net present value rate. I think somebody told you this last week, but I'm going to repeat it again because it bears repeating. First of all, the MISO market price means a lot of different things to a lot of different people, and this bill doesn't make it clear what that is. It can be system-wide. It can be at the Minnesota hub. It can be at a particular node. For purposes of my calculation, I assumed you meant that we're going to go back and take the MISO average round the clock, day ahead market price at the Minnesota node. And because MISO doesn't actually publish that index, in order to get it, I actually had to go back and take the average of the 12-month averages, which they do publish. So there's a technical issue on how you define this price. This price, as the way it's written in this legislation, could be interpreted in a number of different ways. I think the second issue is that this is not an easily found published number, which I think we all like to have when we have indexes. And so, you know, there are sort of two options with this. One is that we can work around to find an easily found published number. The other is that we can ask MISO if they would agree to calculate and publish this number. And they may agree to do that. But I think the real key to remember, those technical issues aside, are that you're not setting a price that's related to market. And I think that this bill is trying to make you think that you are. The second issue is, if you look at the amendment, Section 2, Subdivision 3B, it actually says here that the tariff has to be the net present value equal to the annual average of the previous year rate. I believe that they're actually looking for the net present value rate here. The net present value, if it were actually the $48, then we would probably be paying something in the area of about 3 cents a megawatt hour for this wind, and I don't think that's what you intended. But net present value rate is a defined term in the statute, and it can be corrected. Secondly, mathematical error to say that the net present value rate is calculated over the term of the contract. The net present value rate is a single point calculation that's made on a stream of payments. So there's some technical issues, there's some drafting issues in the bill that we would really like to see corrected if this is the policy that the committee takes forward. Finally, I'd like to talk a little bit, well, not finally, because I still have my standard contract change, but I'd like to talk a little bit about seabed issues in general. We all think seabed is a great idea. It's a great idea to try to keep things local and local in the community. But one of the concerns that we truly have about this is that the current law is extremely vague with respect to how we count projects, gross revenues, who they have to go to, what constitutes sending them to local entities. And it invites very, very loose seabed definitions under which qualifying owners invest as little as $75 per turbine, with the remainder of an equity, with the remainder of the equity coming from out-of-state equity partners in order to create a seabed project. So not only are you potentially creating a project that has a huge price, $500,000 per 5 megawatt project, but you might actually be sending it out of the state, because it's not clear who these owners are, where the money's going to, and how do you qualify for a seabed project? You send a letter to the Office of Energy Security, and you say, I have a seabed project, and this is what the structure looks for, and they sign a letter saying, yeah, this would qualify for a seabed project, but there's never an audit. There's never any accountability that says, where did that money go? How much of it went locally? What are you counting as local revenues? And so I think when you're looking at giving a project a premium price, you need to give it some accountability. Finally, I am going to wrap up now by talking a little bit about standard contract issues. Xcel Energy supports the development of standard contracts. We are not going to spend a lot of time pointing fingers over all of the failures of seabed. We understand that the contracting process has been as difficult as some of the other things, as getting turbines and getting financing. Not quite as difficult as interconnecting to the grid, because I don't think there's anything as difficult as that out there, but certainly it's been difficult. And we do think, we agree with Representative Falk, that there are certainly ways that we can come up with some standard terms and conditions that we can put forward and say, this is your seabed contract. Our one concern about the language of the standard contract in the bill is that the Public Utilities Commission doesn't do a whole lot in 90 days. And certainly a process whereby we need to sit down and agree on legal terms of business conditions that both parties are going to enter into that adequately protect their financial interests, not just Xcel Energy, but also the developer, it is going to take more than 90 days. And so for that reason, we would urge you to allow more time for the commission to set the contracts than are in these contracts. I can't actually tell you how much time it would take. It would actually probably be easier for somebody from the commission or the OES to give some sort of a projection. But certainly that was one thing that people also agreed on in the Seabed Task Force, is that even though we should be able to get the standard contract or some kind of template, it wasn't something that we were going to be able to do overnight. That concludes my testimony at this point. I'm happy to answer any questions that you have.
Ms. Angle King, one thing that perhaps you could clarify for us, you sort of gave us the history of Xcel's attempts to contract for seabed projects, a number of which could not be developed. What typically or primarily has been the reason for that? Has this been a question of obtaining financing? And if it has that been related to an inability to achieve financing at the negotiated price?
Representative Hilsey, Mr. Chair, the number one reason that we haven't been able to move forward with projects has been the congestion in the MISO queue. We have not been able to interconnect projects to the grid. The number two reason that we have not been able to connect projects or even fulfill signed contracts has been the inability of developers to receive turbines. The turbine market's been very tight. Unless you are connected to somebody who has a very good frame agreement with one of the major turbine developers, it is difficult to get turbines. And, you know, that's, I think, one of the barriers that, you know, we need to explore, seeing whether we can break down in order to enable more seabed. I do not understand that financing has ever been raised as an excuse to not bring us project forward, and certainly we've been very, very flexible on changing the terms of the pricing, even on signed contracts, in order to attempt to bring project forward.
Thank you. I have Representative Beard and then Representative Westrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Angle King, back to your notes you were giving, I was fascinated with the amount of offering and what's actually in the ground. The 2006 offering ended up with 78 megawatts, is that right? That's actually online and performing?
Yes.
What was your 2007 numbers again? 700 offered and what actually?
2 megawatts.
2's actually up and running?
Are up and running. And that actually is our total of, I think it's probably published somewhere officially as 79.5 megawatts as what we have up and running in terms of seabed projects.
Okay.
Representative Beard?
Just for the fun of it, Mr. Chair, not that it relates to this, but because I pay attention to these things, I was coming in this morning and noticed the Highbridge plant was roaring away full speed ahead, both stacks just shooting gas in the air, gas exhaust, of course. So I checked with my my source and see how we're doing for wind. This morning we were pulling about 240 megawatts of wind into the system on a very cold morning. It was -4 at my house again this morning. Just so, by the way, about a month ago, it was 31 below here one morning. It was dead calm. So I checked to see how we were doing on wind. And there was no wind in the system. And they were burning everything that could burn to keep the base going. And, oh, by the way, most of the windmills were shut down. I did not know that. And it turned into actually 39 kW loads on average, because we have to run heaters, keep the oil and the water from freezing when the machines are feathered because the temperature is too cold. So that's not your issue, Ms. Angle King. That's one for this committee just to ponder. When the base load is, the biggest demand is on the base, which now is in the winter months in Minnesota, we're burning everything we can burn, members. Just keep the lights on, the heat running, and the other things we've grown accustomed to up here. So, just, oh, by the way, but 240 megs this morning, and they were running the Highbridge plant, and I know about what that costs us a kilowatt hour, and it's not pretty.
A little prettier now that gas prices are down.
Yeah, that's been helpful.
Representative Weston.
Representative Purcell. Chair, I got a few questions, so just please indulge me. By the way, what is the price on the Highbridge plant kilowatts right now, being the topic came up?
Nathaniel King.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrum, I don't know what today's gas price is, but at a $7 gas price, it's about $49 a megawatt hour. 4.9 cents a kilowatt hour.
Okay. What does that equate to get to $10 or $12? What's any idea?
You know, if you take the price of gas and you multiply it times 7, that'll give you your base, and that'll give you your price per megawatt hour. So when it's 10 or 12, when it's $10, it's about $70 a megawatt hour.
Okay. $12 would be just over $100, or about $100?
Just under $100.
Just under $100.
Representative Western.
Ms. Engel King, when you talked about the failed projects, you had signed 200 megawatts, 678 came on. So the others failed. How do you count them as failed? Are they aren't online, they're coming, they ran into drawbacks, holdups, where they really just, they're totally failed, they've sent you notice, and you know that they're not going to be around, so you're looking for more megawatts.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrum, when I talk about failed projects, I essentially talk about projects that we have signed contracts for, which are in default, because they have not met certain milestones. Now, we've had a number of things happen to some of these projects that are in default. Some of them, we have they've been in default of their contract. They've come back and they've made new proposals to us with new prices and with other features that they believe are workable, and we've negotiated new agreements with them. Some of them, we have not terminated the contract, because just because the contract is in default doesn't mean we have to terminate it. It means we have the option. We've not terminated the contract, and we've continued to work. For example, this contract where we've taken 3 pricing amendments back to the commission, as well as an amendment that would give us the opportunity to be flexible about the cost of transmission upgrades. And so we're still working with some of those projects in hopes that they can be developed and offering them some very flexible terms. Other projects will end the contract, and then they will come back and they will propose their project again, or they'll end a negotiation. So, for example, in this CBED solicitation where we just received proposals, haven't actually seen everybody who's proposed, but I would imagine that we have projects that also proposed to us in June of 2008, in July of 2007, and possibly even in 2006 solicitation. So projects continue to try to move forward. You know, we are trying as flexibly as we can. I think one of the reasons a lot of these projects have come back is now that we've tried to break the MISO 2 logjam, and that some of them may actually be able to get interconnected now. And that's our first hope. I think another reason we've seen so much response to this CBED RFP is that we have a firm 3-year extension to the production tax credit. And the production tax credit makes all the difference in being able to. Which actually reminds me of something that I didn't say in my testimony, which I thought about, which is we're conferring a premium price on these projects, but in nowhere are we prohibiting them from receiving a production tax credit as well. Even though in the explanation for why this bill is important, we're saying that we want Minnesotans to be able to develop renewable energy even though they can't take advantage of it. In reality, what happens, you heard what happens, it's the Minnesota flip, which is a very ingenious financing structure that hopefully will bring local benefits to Minnesota at one point. We haven't actually made it through all the way to a flip yet to see if that's going to happen. But what really happens is this all goes to equity partners who can take advantage of these tax credits. So you're not really giving these people 9.5 or 10 cents a kilowatt hour. You're actually giving them 13 cents a kilowatt hour because they're taking the tax credits as well.
Mr. Chair, my questions just keep expanding as the testimony keeps coming, but that's fine. That's what this bill of hearing is all about. On the production tax credit, how many cents per kilowatt are we at with the production tax credit right now?
Single thing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrum, I might not be able to give you an exact number because I actually have not looked at my last look at that production tax credit was that it was about 2 cents a kilowatt hour, and it escalates each year according to inflation. But I haven't actually looked closely at the stimulus bill to say what that is.
Representative West.
Mr. Chair, that's more consistent with what I recall it being at. It was 1.8. Your example just exaggerated it to be 3 cents at least, and I want the audience and the members to know that I'm not aware of a production tax credit that would raise rates from 9.5, 10 cents to 13 cents. And so I would ask that maybe you're a little more cautious with your numbers. I know you're trying to argue against the rate and against the policy, et cetera, but let's get back to the signing new contracts. How fast do you work these contracts through when they need to be amended or originally come through to you? 2 weeks, 1 month, 2 months? What's the typical turnaround time?
That's angle, okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrum, I apologize. I don't mean to try to expand. What I'm really talking about is sort of the amount of money that's going into a developer's pocket for these projects. And, you know, actually a 2 cent tax credit does confer a benefit of about 3 cents on the developer. And so that's why I used that example. In terms of the time that it takes to contract, like I said, I can't point fingers at everybody on CBED without also pointing in the mirror, because it has taken a long time to develop some of these contracts, sometimes 12 to 18 months, and I will agree on that point. To the extent that we work with a couple of lawyers who are aware of how the CBRED agreements work out, and when we do get one contract when done with them, we tend to get them done much faster. Sometimes, once we have agreed on what the price of the project is, sometimes we can get it done in 4 to 6 months as we move through the contract. I think that can speed up, and like I said, I think standard contracts can go a long way toward helping that happen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. That is my point. 12 to 18 months drives up the cost for everybody. The lawyers send out bills time and time again. That has been the experience I've heard from people. I haven't found people that have told me in 4 months, which I think is for an amendment to a contract, this sure seems like it could go faster than 4 months, but I haven't found parties to tell me that that's how fast you're turning them around. So I think you've just made some good arguments for parts or reasons for this bill and why it's in front of us. I've heard frustration for years before CBED was even around, and since CBED is around. And so I think it's good for the members here to understand that that is the struggle that goes on. And he who holds the gold is the king. And when you're the one holding the contract for the power purchase agreement to decide who gets it, they're going to sit on their knees for 18 months if they have to get that amended contract. That is part where this bill has come out of. That's the problem. But let me explore another avenue with you.
Representative Westrum, if you could keep it kind of brief, we have four more people that are scheduled to testify. It's past 7:30 and would like to move on this bill this evening.
Mr. Chair, I think it's important that we try to get some facts out here, but I'll try to be real brief. What is new coal or new baseload power costing you right now when you build it or propose it at Xcel?
Zangle King.
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrum, at this point we have not proposed any what you would call new coal or new baseload in our resource plan. The baseload that's in our resource plan currently would come from expanding the capacity of our current nuclear stations And in doing so, we would obtain about 300 megawatts of new nuclear capacity at a cost that is roughly about it's about $1,200 a kW, and I think that compares to about $2,500 a kW for putting in a wind turbine, and at a dispatch cost of about 1.5 cents a kilowatt hour. And so we've actually looked for some very cost-effective ways to add baseload. What we actually find is with the renewable energy standard, and Xcel does have a slightly more aggressive renewable standard than the other utilities, that we don't need any new baseload in the next 15 to 20 years of our plan. In fact, we are getting so much energy from the wind that our entire plan is around building flexible facilities that we can operate around the wind, mostly gas facilities, but also some hydro through contracts with Manitoba Hydro and some other things. And so as a result, now if you're really going to talk about a new coal plant is going to cost you about $3,000 a kW, and it's going to cost you probably at an all-in cost somewhere between $85 and $100 a megawatt hour to run. It's extremely expensive, and that's one of the reasons why we're not planning one right now, not to mention the carbon risk.
Mr. Chair, I'll be brief.
Arizona West.
So on that plan, would you lock in 20 years of price at $85 to $100 a megawatt? Is that a locked-in price for 20 years, 30 years, how many years?
Mr. Chair, Representative Westrum, because it would most likely be an owned plant, you would be locking in the cost. It's a lot of it is capital cost. You'd be locking in a lot of the cost for the 35-year to 40-year life of the plant. But certainly, there would be escalation in O&M costs as well as fuel costs over that life. I think we all look at coal as a fairly stable. But I think that the real point here is that Xcel Energy would not do that, because we don't want to pay that price. We don't want to have our ratepayers pay that price. And we don't want to take the carbon risk. And actually, Xcel Energy is, I think, a huge supporter of wind. We're the number one purchaser of wind energy in the country. We have aggressively pursued seabed projects and have worked to put them in. We've aggressively pursued other wind projects to the extent that we have more than 1,200 megawatts online. And we really have viewed this as our future. Our future is wind and the things that we operate around wind to make our system work.
So Mr. Chair, I'll just draw my conclusion
Western.
People that it maybe wasn't clear to, and hopefully it's clearer when I draw my conclusion here. If you look at the price we're talking about for 20 years locked in for seabed energy, natural gas being the logical backup in most cases, other possibilities exist. As she said, $49 to $100 a megawatt is the natural gas price now. That's the cost, reimbursement, plant expense. You've got 7 to 8 cents net present value seabed under this contract. I'm not seeing where the horrific out-of-line costs are that some are talking about. If you're going to build new other base load, and what I just talked about does get you base load, you're talking similar types of costs, if not higher. And you don't lock in your fuel rates for 20 years. So, Mr. Chair, I just hope the people would look at the whole picture, that these costs elsewhere are not so much cheaper, that this is out of line as some are at least alleging.
Thank you. Representative Purcell, can you be very brief?
I'll be very brief. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I regret that Representative Beard isn't had to leave, but I just want to report to the committee my observation that with my personal wind turbine, I have no cold weather issues. So,
thank you, Angle King. Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Logtuck. You're next on the agenda. Did you still want to testify? I understood. Perhaps you didn't.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Lauren Lotzak from Otter Trail Power. I had told Mr. Pomeroy that I would not need to testify, and in light of the testimony of both GRE and Excel, I think that's largely the case, although I just wanted to mention one thing, because I follow federal affairs for my company, Otter Trail Power. In Subdivision 1, the language that mentions the inability of small generators to benefit from existing federal tax credit and other financial incentives. Section 1603 of the recently signed into law H.R. 1, the stimulus bill, contains a provision for small generators who can't take advantage of the production tax credit or the investment tax credit under H.R. 1 will be able to receive a check from the Treasury for 30% of the project cost, and that will be an upfront check. Well, I shouldn't say that. At the point in time at which the project is put online, an application to the Treasury will bring a check for 30% of the project. So a $10 million project would have its upfront cost reduced by $3 million. So I think that's a very positive development for non-taxpaying entities, and I would think that some CDUD kinds of projects that folks would be able to take advantage of that. So something positive coming from the stimulus bill for CDUD projects. That's all I wanted to add, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
That's good news. Thank you, Mr. Lodge. Mr. Scheibel?
Good evening, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I'm David Scheibel. I'm founder and president of Norfolk Wind Energy, a Renville County community-based wind energy project founded in 2007 by 10 local farmers and business people. On behalf of Norfolk Wind Energy, let me express my appreciation for the opportunity to testify in support of this legislation. I'd like to share with you a little bit about our project and the investment that I believe the state of Minnesota and other governmental entities have had into our project. Our project currently has a 40 megawatt application with MISO for a transmission interconnect into the grid at a sweet spot identified in the June 16, 2008 Dispersed Renewable Generation Transmission Study completed by the Minnesota Office of Energy Security. The state of Minnesota, through the DIG study and the Renewable Energy Development Initiative administered by the Southwest Minnesota Initiative Foundation and through resources provided by the Minnesota Department of Commerce, along with the Renville County EDA, have invested indirectly in our project by providing time, energy, and resources to Norfolk Wind. We are very appreciative of these governmental entities that have been willing to aid a project such as ours that is in a non-traditional area for wind energy development. As a result, our seabed project now has 26 local investors, virtually all of whom purchased their power from the local RA and XL Energy, and they have committed and invested nearly $500,000 of their own at-risk capital to the development of this 40-megawatt project. We anticipate additional investments of over $1 million to be made by additional local investors to fund completion of the development cost of our project. Norfolk Wind Energy's proposed 40-megawatt project exists today in part because of the foresight of the Renville County EDA and considerable help from Minnesota government entities that have been funded by the state of Minnesota. We are hopeful for successful completion of our project, and projects like ours are dependent upon access into the electrical grid. We ask you to consider continued seabed legislation that allows for projects of our size to participate in preferred interconnect arrangements. And if I may, as I complete my testimony here, I would like to ask that you allow me to yield to Mr. Pat Pelstrin from National Wind, our development energy partner, to provide additional testimony.
Certainly that will be possible. If you want to come forward?
Good Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Pat Pelstring. I'm founder and principal with National Winds. National Winds is a 50-person wind development company based out of Minneapolis, and we only partner with landowners in our development. I've been fascinated by the testimony this evening, and I think you'll be pleased to hear I've been crossing out parts of my testimony as these issues have been covered, so I can keep my comments pretty brief. First of all, just so you can kind of get a little bit of a better perspective, we currently have 6 seabed-eligible wind development projects in Minnesota, and the founders of our company are the developers of the largest seabed project, which is the Jeffers Wind Project in Cottonwood County. This is a 50-megawatt project, which was comprised of 20 Clipper 2.5-megawatt turbines, and it sells its power to Xcel Energy. The project company, the seabed company Summit Wind, is comprised of more than 35 local landowners and investors. It really represents the promise for significant value and wealth creation that's available for Minnesota landowners through your support of the expanded seabed commitment. Currently, we have 6 projects. High Country Energy, which is in Maurer, Olmsted, and Dodge counties, planned for up to 400 megawatts. Root River Energy in Maurer and Fillmore counties, planned for up to 300 megawatts. Goodview Wind Energy, of course, in Goodview County, which is planned for 78 megawatts. Little Rock Wind, which is a takeoff of Big Stone County, and that project's planned for up to 150 megawatts. Lake Country Energy, located in Meeker and Candy, Ohio counties, planned for 350 megawatts. And Norfolk Wind, located in Renfrew County, as Mr. Scheibel was advising. These projects currently have over 400 participating landowners and investors, and the development potential will likely result in over 1,200 landowners being directly involved in these projects. Now, surely not all of these projects will be developed as seabed PPA projects. Many may be sold as construction-ready projects to our area utilities, but in this case, with local ownership, even the project sale proceeds transfer through to the prospective local owners. And we've even had a Wisconsin utility that is committed to build a project in partnership with our Dodge County investors and landowners for a High Country project. So a couple of comments about the legislation, and it's open for questions or depart as you'd like. First of all, I think you probably should be proud with Ms. Engelking's comments that there were 2,000 megawatts of seabed bid into the recent Xcel RFP. I think that's an indication that, you know, Minnesota's been a national leader in this industry, and you've really created a burgeoning industry. There are developers such as ourselves, Geronimo, Mr. Jewell, that are actually creating actual development jobs in the state that didn't exist 5 years ago. And that, too, I think, is an indication of the fact that the state's been a leadership, proven their leadership. Very quickly, I want you to understand what the prospective impact is on having a local project, seabed-based, on a PPA. And let's take it to the level, as the Xcel people were discussing, that if you can get a 50 or 100-megawatt seabed project, which are out there, a 100-megawatt project would generate about $530 million over a 20-year time period. With a typical corporate developer, you're looking at local leases at about $18 million and local taxes at about $9 million. Something in the neighborhood of $27 million of that $532 million would stay in the local community, about 5.2%. Now, according to our estimates, with the National Wind model, the equity flip model that that Mr. Jewell has been advancing, we would have likely the same project revenue, $532 million over a 20-year time period. We, too, would have leases, although generally the leases are a little more lucrative in a seabed project, local taxes, but you'd add to that distributions and fees, even with an equity partner that may be out of state, to suggest that $110 million or fully 21% of the revenue off of that project would stay in the state. In other words, $80 million on 100 megawatt project is the increase that could be generated to the state by using the equity flip model. Tremendous amount of influence, I think, in what you're ultimately generating. Let me turn now just to the MISO issue, which I think we've talked a lot about. I'll close my comments. First of all, the state was a big supporter of the DRG study, and I have to say that we were a supporter of that as well. Filed 7 interconnection filings based upon the results of the DRG study, and worked with area communities to generate those interconnection requests. Unfortunately, only 3 of those made it into DPP with MISO. And in fact, if you look at the MISO process right now, it's becoming a process of the well-heeled developer that can really support the interconnection process. And if you look at the Jewel Winds and the Geronimos and the National Winds, people from Minnesota were fighting to make sure that the benefits of those projects end up with the landowners in Minnesota. You're going to find out that it is the, let me call it the developers with corporate offices thousands of miles from here that have got the balance sheet to drive the interconnection process to get projects done. We, plain and simply, in the current MISO process, the big developers, the big balance sheet developers, can buy their way through the interconnection process and beat us to the punch. And I think that's part of the problem you're seeing with Xcel, unable to bring as many of the seabed projects to fruition. We are a strong supporter, even though we work with larger projects, of the small projects. That's really been the generation and the history of this state in establishing a national reputation for community development and community wind. We need to continue to support those 5-megawatt projects because that in turn then generates the interest and the commitment of all the landowners willing to participate in the larger projects that we've described. So we would urge you to move forward with this legislation. We strongly support it. We think, as we said, you above and beyond provided the assistance to the landowners. You're now creating an industry that didn't exist in this state. And by continuing to focus on assuring that at least 800 megawatts of seabed projects get built over the next 3 or 4 years, so you're going to add to the economic vitality of the state in general. Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no questions at this time. Mr. Pellestrink, thank you. Mr. Bull.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll try to be brief. I may not be genetically capable, but I'll try to be brief. I'm Mike Bull. I'm a policy manager for an organization called Wind on the Wires. We're a program of the Isaac Walton League of America and a collaboration between the wind industry and clean energy advocates, environmental groups throughout the Midwest, Fresh Energy, Yikes, Environmental Law and Policy Center, Renew Wisconsin, and a number of others. Focused on developing and promoting policies to promote wind power throughout the Midwest. We are, as a general rule, we are agnostic on the question of ownership with regard to the wind power that we are promoting. Both of the developers that have talked to you tonight, Blake and Pat, their organizations are participants in our collaborative. We have a number of others. And I think as a general rule, we think that just about every wind development in the Midwest that serves Minnesota benefits Minnesota in a number of different ways. And it's the policies that we've been working on over a number of years to help blend those benefits and optimize those for the ratepayer. Personally, I have been long been a supporter of community energy. Before I came to Wind on the Wire, as many of you know, I was the deputy director of the Minnesota Office of Energy Security, and in that role, it was my job to help manage the programs that we have in the state to support community energy and help create many of those programs, including the seabed program. I worked with Dan Jewell and George Crocker and Mr. Falk to get the underlying statute passed in 2005. So this is something that I've been working on for a number of years. I had the pessimistic thought as I was sitting back there listening is that I'd much rather maybe go to the dentist for root canal than sit through another hearing on seabed, because it's something that we've been working on very studiously over a number of years, and the difficulties have been huge. I do want to thank Representative Falk. He's done, I think, a really good job with this bill so far. We've brought some issues to his attention, and he has incorporated into the DE3 amendment some changes that really do reduce the significant ratepayer impact of the bill, and also, as you heard, it also has mitigated the impact on seabed developments that are currently under in progress. I think Geronimo Wind, in particular, had intended to come and testify against the proposal, and with the changes that Representative Falk is bringing to the committee, now it has flipped his testimony to be in favor of the proposal. And that shows, I think, that Representative Falk is very serious about working with folks on this bill and working through the significant issues that we raised. And we do have three continuing issues that I think we'll need to continue to work on with Representative Falk and others as this bill moves forward. And I'll just briefly run through those for you. The biggest issue is the impact of the way the 800-megawatt carve-out for seabed is structured. It's in lines 2.6 to 2.13. The way that carve-out is structured, it holds off all other renewable energy development for a number of years while we work through getting the 800 megawatts up and running, and not just under contract, but actually operational and generating electricity. This could put our compliance with the state's renewable electricity standard back 2, 3, 4 years, and I know that that's not Representative Falk's intention, and I know that that would not be the intention of the committee. So that's something that I think we need to be very cognizant about and work through. And I think you've also heard to a large extent that some of these changes in this section aren't necessary, that through 2005 to the end of 2007, we did only have 2.5 megawatts of seabed installed. It was one project and one turbine. But since then, throughout the course of 2008, Minnesota installed 115 megawatts, or over 115 megawatts of seabed. It's which was fully a quarter of all the wind installed in the state in that year. It's also somewhat coincidentally that I left the state during that time period, and all of a sudden seabed starts to work, but my own personal cross to bear. I think two more points I'd like to make about that is that those, and I think Ms. Engelking pointed this out as well, those installations were cost competitive with other installations over the course of that year. Those installations did not require a premium. And one final point about the current program, we have amount of seabed was installed under the old PTC. In the current stimulus package, there has been some significant changes to the federal incentives that may actually spur, be much more beneficial to community wind than under the previous federal incentive. So, to a large extent, utilities and developers are starting to work through the issues on how to get seabed projects into their system. Ms. Engelstein talked in detail about this. There are still some utilities and some developers that need to be goosed. That they need to, you know, there's a, I have written down here that there's a rectal implantation problem that somehow we should just figure out how to address, but maybe I'll just move on. So, my second issue, don't make me use this. It's late, Mr. Chair, I'm sorry about that. My second issue also has to do with the impact on the renewable electricity standard itself, and this is also important to the environmental community. As we developed and put together the renewable electricity standard back in 2007, many of you who were here remember that we talked a lot about off-ramps, how to structure opportunities for when a utility is set to implement the renewable electricity standard and it sees that it's going, that the implementation of the standard is going to potentially have large cost impacts or reliability impacts on its system, that it can go to the commission and get the, and the commission has the authority under the statute to modify or suspend the renewable energy standard with regard to that utility. We structured those off-ramps so that they would be last resort options. And one of the concerns that we had have as the cost impact of the current bill that's before you may be such that it's much more likely that we'll use those off-ramps, in which case we will have potentially, we will again delay the renewable energy standard or reduce the renewable energy standard. And again, I know that's not Representative Fox's intention. So we will need to continue, as the bill moves forward and before it gets to the governor, we will need to continue to reduce those ratepayer impacts or otherwise shield the RES from those potential impacts. And finally, an issue that Ms. Engelstein touched on as well is the seabed certification and enforcement. The current program, which I helped create and helped oversee, is a loose program. It is, you know, there's a loose obligation on the part of the utility to look for seabed projects as it's putting together its plan to meet the RES. And on the other side, the definitions for what constitutes a seabed project are also very loose. This fuzziness was intended to give additional flexibility into the system to make sure, to make it easier for projects to come online. But that's under that loose program. We're starting to structure, this mandated structure would be need a much more clear set of definitions as to what constitutes a seabed project. And I think you'd also want a very formal formal certification and enforcement process so that utilities know what projects are qualifying for their mandate and that you know that the money that goes where you are directing it to go, that this thing, the amount of money that you're requiring to stay local stays local, and that you have confidence that this premium rate, whatever that ends up being, that has the benefits that you're intending to have. One of the issues, just as an aside, with the current definitions, to give you a sense, is that the current definitions allow a single person, a single Minnesotan, to own a 5-megawatt project. And in that respect, you'll have, I'd love to get a hold of one of those projects. The bill would make me a multimillionaire the next day, and I think that that's again the point of the legislation is to disperse benefits of seabed and not to concentrate them. So that's we need to continue to work on those issues. I spoke on Friday with a South Dakota Public Utilities Commissioner Gary Hansen, who indicated a significant problem that their commission has with the legislation. He was planning to send a letter to Representative Hilty and Representative Falk, but I don't know that that took place. But the issues that he was raising and that he made me promise I would let you know is that there may be constitutional issues with the proposal as it stands currently, interstate commerce issues, with requiring a Minnesota utility purchase Minnesota-based products and leaving South Dakota businesses out of that market. And that's a legal issue that I'm not qualified to detail for you, but I promised I'd raise it to your attention. And finally, my last point is, regardless of whether, it goes back to the mission of Wind on the Wires, regardless of whether you're a community project or a non-community project, the single biggest hurdle to getting wind energy onto the grid is the lack of transmission capacity. These small projects, the larger seabed projects, the larger traditional projects, all face the same set of constraints when it comes to transmission capacity, and we won't be able to, none of these projects will generate any benefits locally if they're not able to get onto the grid, and if they won't be able to get onto the grid if we don't have additional transmission capacity added. That sort of encapsulates my comments on behalf of Wind of the Wires, and I'll be happy to stand for any questions. And I promise not to use any bad words.
I got Representative Kim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bull, you identified yourself as former deputy director of the Office of Energy Security, but I understood that you were actually the assistant commissioner of the Department of Commerce. So, you know, if you could clear that up for us, that would be very helpful. But in all honesty,
it was the same job.
You weren't also the deputy reliability administrator, were you?
I was not.
Okay, good.
You wore so many hats, you see the result.
Well, Mr. Bull, you know, the main reservation I have about Representative Falk's bill is goes to the section that you pointed out, the Section 3 Subdivision 5. I'm wondering if you might be willing to toss an idea on the table or two about how to resolve the challenge of the potential blockage, the piece that needs goosing, to use your term. And then I have a follow-up question to this, and Mr. Chair.
Mr. Bull. Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, we have member participants in Wind of the Wire that love this section and members that hate this section.
They're doing great.
I answer this question at my peril. My sense is that if all of these changes came out of the bill and that you made an indication to all the utilities that you expect the progress that we're making on seabed to continue, that could have an impact. There are utilities that get the importance of adding seabed to their portfolio, and to that extent, I don't believe that the mandate is necessary. But there are utilities that I think don't. And to that extent, maybe a legislative goosing is useful. If I haven't answered your question, that's because I'm trying really hard not to.
I'll give you, Mr. Chair, I'll give you another question that you can talk your way around. And that is whether you feel like a California-style post-Enron loading order that essentially says it has a hierarchy of resources by which one drops down a rung based on cost effectiveness, starting with efficiency and conservation, and when one hits the renewables, the very high, fairly high up rung, that there would be separate rungs for community wind versus large wind, or seabed in our terms and non-seabed. Would that have a potential of resolving this issue while still meeting the expansion of seabed?
Mr. Bull. Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, I'm concerned, I understand what you're getting at. What I'd be concerned at, I think it's a level of
management, I hate to use the term micromanagement, but management of the work of the resource planners of some of the utilities, that they blend and they review a number of issues that I think they need the flexibility to do that. So I'm not sure that necessarily is the sharp tool that we're looking for in this respect. But I appreciate the thinking. I just think it might have the same kind of effect on the other kinds of development, renewable developments that we're expecting for the state, and that I think will have significant benefits for the state.
Members, I do want to give Mr. Crocker the opportunity to give us a few words, and then we are going to act on this bill. If we need to, we'll bring it back before the committee at a later date, but I do want to allow it if the committee desires to go forward. Mr. Crocker.
Thank you, Chairman Hilty. My name is George Crocker. I'm the Executive Director of the North American Water Office, and I do really appreciate you taking the time, late though it is, to hear a few words. I would really encourage members to remember that the renewable energy standard is not a ceiling. What this legislation attempts to do is create a floor that can actually enable additional increments on into the future of community-based energy to go forward. Towards that end, much of the discussion that you have heard this evening against this legislation has to do with the price attached to the seabed project of 5 megawatts or less. I would encourage you to remember that this bill establishes a two-tier seabed process. For all of the projects that are greater than 5 megawatts, standard contract, yes. Template we can work with if that's what we need to do. But the price is negotiated. The price for projects that are 5 megawatts, that are greater than 5 megawatts, is a negotiated price in the power purchase agreement. It is not subject to any specific tariff. Now, that said, as you recall from the testimony of Ms. Engel-King, all of the projects that did come through were greater than 5 megawatts. For the last couple of years, this has been true. All of those projects would continue to have to negotiate the power purchase price. It is somewhat disingenuous, in my opinion, to suggest that a hub market, and I should also say we're willing to work out whatever technical issues there are to deal with making this bill compatible and to comport with whatever it needs to meet the ongoing desires of the committee and of the legislature, but the MISO price, the hub price, the Minnesota hub price, is a market-derived price. The net present value calculation driven by the utility's cost of capital is driven by a cost of capital that is filed with regulatory agencies. These are market-derived numbers. It's not like they're being made up. They are numbers that come from transactions that happen in historical periods of time, and we're trying to apply those to the less 5 megawatts or less projects. Now, with the five projects that are 5 megawatts and less, we're attempting to figure out what to compare them to, and that is difficult. You also heard that's a moving project. We have some levelized contracts. We have some escalating contracts. We have contracts that are all proprietary, so we have to sort of guess at what corporate projects are doing at any point in time. It is a reasonable set of assumptions to assume, as you have in the handout, a discount rate of in the neighborhood of 5%, and with a beginning price of around $70 per megawatt hour. If you do escalate that at 2% per year, which is not unreasonable for the kind of power purchase prices we will be seeing going forward into the future, it is not unreasonable to speculate that the kind of energy future we will be living is accurately represented by the two graphs that were handed to the committee today. One is entitled The Corporate Contract versus MISO Price,
and the other is CBED contract price versus MISO price. Looking at the corporate contract price, this graph, what this points out is that if the MISO price escalates, in other words, the Minnesota hub price, and it really doesn't matter where you start, but if it escalates at 5% per year, and if you have a corporate contract price that escalates at 2% per year, why then, for the first 18 years of that contract, why the project gets the benefit of the deal. Beyond that, the value swings for the ratepayer. Compare that to a CBED contract that starts out higher at the $97 per megawatt hour. If starting at the existing market price of $50 per megawatt hour, that continues to escalate at 10% or 5% per year, you will note that only 11 years out, in other words, the CBED project beats the corporate project by a matter of some 6 years in terms of the value that it brings to the community, in terms of ratepayer impacts. The final thing that I'd like to say to the committee is to take a look at the pie charts that we did hand out. I think you have color versions of them, which make them a little easier to see than the black and white ones. But this is for a 5 megawatt and less project. The 5 megawatt and less projects are particularly attractive for a couple reasons, one of which, they're of the size that enables the local debt, the local bank to be servicing local debt. If a project costs $2,000 per installed kilowatt, what we're looking at for a 5-megawatt project is in the neighborhood of $10 million. That means if you got a 50-50 debt equity split, you're talking about $5 million. That's within the range of Main Street bankers. That is money that can stay local. That is not a project that will be negotiated by a professional power purchase negotiation, which is why we want a price for it. So you have an assurance going in that this is a project that is financeable and that is viable, and that you don't need to be a rocket scientist in order to participate in community-based wind. Compare that to the bottom pie chart, which is in which virtually all of the revenue that we've made, it's our commitment for renewable energy, we're paying for it, we're living with the infrastructure, and all of the money leaves. You think this is a recipe to get enough wind to make any difference for a renewable energy standard? I'd encourage you to think again, if that's what you're thinking. Now, if you look at the pie chart on the top, this is assuming the 18% or the 16% that leaves the state is assuming that your equity partner is outside of the state. If the debt is serviced local and the equity partner is local, even more of it can stay local. Finally, when we're looking at projects that are 5 megawatts and less, I beg to differ a little bit with my good friend Mike Bull. These are projects, many of which can exist in the existing transmission system or with strategic enhancements to specific substations and specific lower voltage facilities. These are things that can happen quickly. In other words, we can get a much better job of strategically sizing and locating existing plants to take advantage of the existing system, and then strategically enhance that system to catch the next increment and do so very, very quickly. We don't need to wait 7 years for a certificate of need for a high voltage power line in order to bring more community-based energy to market. It's time that we recognize the value that these projects bring to our communities and give them the treatment that allows them to come forward and help provide us with the energy services that we all use all the time. Thank you.
Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good to see you again. Is it true that the only thing form of energy that we have that's higher than your form of seabed is turkey litter?
No. Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunther, there are quite a few forms of energy that are a lot higher. That would include the real cost of nuclear power, if you want to get into that, the real cost of coal, if you want to get into all the particulate and the children that are dumbed down with the mercury and all of those kinds of issues. So there's a whole lot of costs of power. One of the real issues we have with the electric utility industry is that you can pretty much say that anything is cheap if you don't pay for it. And that's pretty much what we do with the electricity. We don't really understand what the cost is.
The prices that we pay are not related to the cost. It's only a series of regulations that define who gets to do what to whom. And as all we're saying is that we should apply the same kind of rules that we apply to revenue streams for other businesses, like a mortgage for a home, to a revenue stream associated with a power flow over time.
Representative Gosser.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Cracker, you mentioned nuclear power. Isn't it true that they're the only ones that pay all their costs, including the cost of disposal they aren't allowed to use? And isn't it true that it's the safest, cleanest, most carbon-free form of producing electricity there is today?
Mr. Cracker.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gosser, no, these are not truth. The fact is that when you make uranium fuel, you're boiling earth over coal fires, and you're cooling it with CFCs in order to boil down the uranium ore to separate out the U-238 from the U-235. So there's a significant carbon component to the uranium fuel cycle, would be the point. When you're talking about the cost of an installed kilowatt of new reactor capacity, you're talking in the neighborhood of $8,000 to $12,000, maybe $7,000 to $12,000 per installed kilowatt. In other words, you could do three times as much wind capacity, recognizing the intermittent nature of wind, so you could spread it out, make up some of that difference in terms of capacity factors, but back it up with biofuels of various sorts, or back it up with almost anything else, and you'd still be cheaper than if you tried to do new reactors. It's clear from the federal legislation and congressional legislation that we have a situation in which Wall Street simply won't go for new reactors.
Gentlemen,
unless
we have a hearing scheduled before the Legislative Energy Commission dealing with nuclear energy. We have a hearing scheduled to deal with the bills that have been introduced regarding nuclear energy in this committee, and I think the business that we have before us this evening is Representative Falk's seabed bill. I don't think it really has anything directly or even in any remote indirect sense to do with nuclear energy. So if we could
Thank
just
you,
stick
Mr.
to
Mr.
the subject,
I'm
I'd
sorry.
Really be grateful. Representative Falk, we'll give you the last word, and then we're going to take a vote on this bill. Representative Hackford.
Mr. Chairman, I wasn't aware of Mr. Crocker, but if we are done with Mr. Crocker, maybe we could have the department come down and say a few words about this bill. We haven't heard from the department on this issue.
I think actually we did in the last hearing, but and they have not asked to testify, but if you have questions for Mr. Gahan or someone else
from
the department, I'd be happy to have them do that. Mr. Glahn, welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, I'm Bill Glahn. I am the Director of the Office of Energy Security, the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Commerce, and I am the Acting Reliability Administrator. I don't know how Mr. Bull got away with that, but I'd be happy to... Oh, sorry, Mr. Chair. Given the late hour, I'm not going to make any prepared remarks, but I'd be happy to answer any questions that the committee would have, and if it would please the committee, actually I left it up there, but I perhaps I could give the committee administrator for distribution some other time. I came up with a list of the 120 or so megawatts of seabed projects that we have. I would echo Mr. Bull's testimony about how we don't have a tight system for regulating what counts as a seabed or cataloging all the various attributes that go along with it, but I thought your members might find it informative.
We'd appreciate it if you could get that to the committee, Mr. Glahn. Representative Hackbarth, you have a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And could you at least elaborate a little bit about the
the projects that are in the system now and are coming forward and how they're going to be affected by this legislation, those kinds of things.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I'd be happy to. We have, Mr. Bull covered already, we have approximately 120 megawatts of seabed projects, some of them self-declared projects, that are up and running. There's another small project in Pipestone that's in the testing phase right now, and it should be online shortly. We have, by our calculations, and again, we, you know, so a lot of this is self-reported or information we've collected on our own. We have another 55 megawatts that we under that we are aware of that are under contract to utilities. Half of that already having received their permits. We also have another 320 megawatts of seabed projects or projects that could become seabed projects that are in the permitting process, in some stage of the permitting process. And that does not include, I was in the interim between our last scheduled time and this time, came across an article in the West Central Tribune talking about a project in Kandiyohi County, if I remember correctly, that is about to enter the permitting process. So that would not be including the Kandiyohi one, in case somebody was reading the West Central Tribune, one of my favorite publications. Also, the office has or is aware of another 290 megawatts at some less developed stage of the process, where they're not quite in permitting yet, but they're been proposed or under discussion. So by our calculations, we have more than 630 megawatts of seabed projects or seabed, what could become seabed projects in the various stages of development. And keep in mind, not all those projects would come to fruition. We heard about some projects that have fallen by the wayside or gone in turnaround, as they might say in Hollywood. And also, it may be that not all projects that get developed will end up being seabed projects. They might get developed under some other guise. But that's our best estimate of what's out there. So it's quite a bit, you know, 630 megawatts in the pipeline, and that's over and above the 120 or so megawatts that we have in the ground today. And I would credit the former deputy director with a lot of that. You know, I don't think it's because of his departure. I think it's purely coincidental.
Representative Hackworth.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Guam. So things seem to be working pretty well at the rates that we're moving forward now and with the rates that are being paid. Why would we need something like this legislation to move forward to get more projects going? I just don't understand the concept of having to pay so much more to get so little as things are moving forward as well as they are.
Mr. Guam. Mr. Chair, Representative, I guess the short answer to your question is it's not obvious to me that and we have some specific problems with the legislation. It's not clear to me how this would necessarily add to the 620. We heard about 2,000 megawatts that applied for the NSP process last week. I suppose it's conceivable it could speed up. One of my particular concerns is that what we heard some testimony at the last hearing about folks with projects already in the pipeline, and they were concerned that if it didn't fall under this category, that they would fall by the wayside. So I'd be concerned about that as well. That is, in fact, it might actually slow down the process for some types of projects if they don't fall in a certain bucket.
Well, and Mr. Chairman, that is exactly my concern, that this is going to happen. And also my concern is that we have these other projects moving forward. They're going to receive one rate, and then we pass this legislation, and some of these other folks are going to get a much, much higher rate. I don't think that's fair. I just don't understand that. I don't know why we bring something forward like this that's going to be so expensive to the ratepayers.
That's fine.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think I would agree with that statement. You know, I'm not going to get bogged down on the cost, but we try to run some numbers to find out what the cost would be over a 20-year life of these projects, and for that 200 megawatts came up with something in the neighborhood of $400 million, which I don't think is inconsistent with some of the numbers we heard from the utilities today. But we have particular concerns about cost, and again, I'm coming in a little late. I don't have the history that Mr. Bull and some of the other earlier testifiers have had on this particular topic, but my recollection of the premise behind the renewable energy standard was we sent the utilities forward. We had, with the charge, to go forth and do 25% or 30% renewable energy, and you go find the best projects. You go find the lowest price
most reliable projects you can find and go contract with those folks to satisfy this mandate with off-ramps if the cost got out of hand. And I was pleased to hear nobody was talking about using off-ramps for the system we have today. And we did do CBED. You've heard about the governor's prior commitment to CBED. And we've heard about all the projects either in the ground or in the pipeline for it. The existing CBED statute already has the front-loaded aspect of it, and the 20-year contract. So we already have a lot of the aspects that we heard were necessary for doing CBED. It's one of these things I'm sure everyone, and I can appreciate folks who are frustrated that we didn't make more progress sooner, but we seem to be making progress at a pretty good clip now, and especially with the encouraging news we heard from NSP and their last the group of offerings that come in, I think it's something that we'd like to see given a chance to succeed under the current form.
Well, thank you, Mr. Glom. And Mr. Chairman,
Representative Hackberg.
I understand that some of the concerns with getting some of these smaller projects on the ground and moving those things forward. I understand those issues. I don't think this bill really gets to that, though. I think this is more of a bill that just is going to cost a lot more money to the ratepayers, and it's going to make a lot of people rich. So I think the bill needs some more work, and, Mr. Chairman, with that, I would move to table the bill and ask for a roll call.
I believe that's a non-debatable motion. Roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll. Chair votes no.
Fox?
No.
Westrom? Anderson? Atkins?
No.
Beard? Sly? Reinert?
No.
Gunther?
Yes.
Hackbar?
Aye.
Hoppy?
Aye.
Johnson?
No.
Kalen?
No.
Knuth? Kulik Jackson?
No.
Magnus? Nornis? Obermuller?
No.
Purcell?
No.
Saylor?
No.
Welty?
Yes.
Carlson? Oh, sorry.
There being four ayes and 11 nays, the motion does not prevail. Representative Hackbarth, I do recognize your concern. I have concerns about the bill as well. And I noticed that Representative Falk, in the course of all of this discussion this evening, was taking copious notes. I expect that he recognizes, as well as do we, that this bill is not in the form that we would like to have it considered on the House floor. I would like to move it to the Commerce Committee, if that's the will of this committee. I'm willing to give Representative Falk an opportunity to fine-tune the bill and I'm perfectly willing to bring it back before this committee before it would advance as far as the House floor if we deem that necessary. I think all of us can maintain communication with Representative Falk and recognize that this is, to a degree, a work in process. Representative Falk, any last words before we take a vote?
I just want to thank Mr. Chair. Thanks to the members of the committee who have endured this process. I think we've had a good debate about it. A couple things. I don't want to ask anybody else to come up, but I did ask Mr. Crocker to prepare some numbers that I can have him send out to the committee, too. But just an average family using 750 kilowatt hours per month, looking at basically an impact of about 19-point-something cents per month with respect to the lower, with the 5-megawatt under project, if the full 200 megawatts was seen throughout the Minnesota system. So we're not talking at huge amounts. What we are talking about is local ownership, and I do strongly disagree with the comments made that this will slow down RES progress. If nothing else, I believe that it will help us keep on track, because when you go out to rural parts of the state and you ask them to give up their resource or to have somebody else develop that resource, they do not have an ownership stake in it. People will work against you. They expect that they will have an ownership stake in the resource, which is rightly theirs. General Clark, I think, articulated the point quite well, that look at what happened in oil-developing nations around the world. They realized the value of what they had, and as a result, they nationalized their resources. We don't want that to happen here. We want to bring partnership to the people whose land these resources will be built on. The utilities cannot just go out there and plop down a wind turbine on somebody's farm site without actually getting, you know, the rights to that property. As these projects continue to be developed, people are learning that they have a right to be an owner in those projects. And so if you want to deny people the right to have ownership in these projects, that's kind of what's happened so far. We want to go and work with them to find a way to ensure that the revenue streams stay in the communities where the resource locates. And it's one of the best ways to facilitate development is by having local ownership, by bringing partnerships in with the people who have the resource. And that has not been the case. This is reactionary policy. We have not seen these community-owned projects being developed at the level that they need to be developed. We have seen them, I think, put on a back burner compared to projects which are owned by the foreign multinational companies. And we have the opportunity here to keep the tax dollars, to keep the jobs, to keep the revenue local. I have a hard time arguing for dollars flowing out state when we can develop this resource and keep it within the state. And we need jobs. We need opportunities in the rural parts of the state. This is a means to address that. And I would entertain that we can continue to work on this. And I know if there's some things people have concerns about, let's talk about that. We'll keep talking about it as it moves through the committee process. But I would like to keep the bill moving from this point. So I would like to renew my motion that the bill is re-referred to, pass and be re-referred to the Commerce Committee.
Representative Falk, that would be House File 357, yes, as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move that House File 357, as amended, be re-referred, recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
Representative Hackworth.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I know that we hear about moving bill forward. A couple of times now, Mr. Chairman, a bill that's been before this committee, that same statement has been made about sending bills on and bringing them back. I'm very, very concerned about that kind of a thing happening and bills coming back and maybe not even addressing some of the issues that we've seen. Mr. Chairman, I just don't see this bill changing the way that we need to see it change. Representative Falk, the issue that you talk about getting the small projects done, this bill does not address that. Let's get a bill that does that, if that's what you want to do. Let's get a bill that's not going to make a select few people multimillionaires. That's what we're doing here, and we're charging our ratepayers an exorbitant amount to make that happen. Mr. Chairman, I'd ask for a roll call vote. I don't see this bill coming back the way we want to see it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just have an issue I'd like to address with Representative Falk and maybe ask if he could elaborate a little bit more, if not now, in the future. You know, I can really see the potential benefit to communities, you know, that currently have wind development potential, with that money going back into the local community, be it the local banks, be it local business, landowners, etc. But my concern with this bill has been that, you know, the entire state isn't all in that situation, you know, with wind in particular. So I guess one thing I would like to have you address, if not now, certainly as this goes forward, you know, the opportunities for seabed other than wind. I know seabed is supposed to be everything, but it doesn't necessarily, you know, encompass things. I would like to see it be, excuse me,
something that had opportunities all around the state, regardless of what source of seabed potential that a community had. So that's just a concern that I have with this bill.
Seeing no further discussion, the clerk will take a roll.
Hilty?
Aye.
Falk?
Aye.
Western? Anderson? Atkins?
Aye.
Spears? Bly? Reinert?
Aye.
Gunther?
No.
Hackbar?
No.
Hoppy?
Nope.
Johnson?
Aye.
Kalen?
Aye.
Knuth?
Aye.
Coolidge Jackson?
Aye.
Magnus? Nornis? Obermuller?
Aye.
Purcell?
Aye.
Saylor?
No.
Welty?
No.
There being 10 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails. The bill is passed and we refer to the Committee on Commerce and Labor.
See you later, my friend.
With that, the meeting is adjourned.